Thanks for downloading this episode of Cork Talk with me, Tim Atkin. A weekly conversation with some of the most famous people in the world of wine.
This podcast is brought to you in partnership with Nomacork by Vinventions. Driven by a commitment to innovation, the new plant-based Nomacork Green Line offers significant improvements in wine closure performance. Thanks to a rigorous oxygen ingress rate, you can decide which cork is best for your wine, whether it's for young and fresh wines or for those with aging potential.
It's rare these days to come across top winemakers who started in the industry at the bottom, pulling hoses and emptying presses with no formal scientific training. But that describes New Zealander Gordon Russell's path to the top. Listen to us talk about his 31 years at Esk Valley in Hawke's Bay, his relationship with the Terraces, one of the country's most iconic vineyards, and why his passions for music, fly fishing and cooking make him better at his day job. Hey, Gordon, how are you?
Yeah, very well, thank you. Nice to see you again. It's been quite a while.
It's been way too long, I have to say, with this bloody pandemic. I've not been able to go anywhere. Neither of you, I'm sure.
No, ordinarily, I think I would be, where are we at, August? I'd be preparing for a trip, arrive on your shores in late September, early October, but couldn't do it last year and won't be doing it this year.
No, well, we miss you, I must say. But where are you now? I mean, you're obviously in New Zealand, but you're in Hawke's Bay?
Yeah, yeah. Home at the beach and in Bayview in the north of Hawke's Bay. And I've got to say, I mean, it's winter here and had, you know, 18-degree day, and I put some sunscreen on when I was out on the links today. So it's been an amazing winter.
Didn't you have a little earthquake tremor recently?
Well, funnily enough, this sounds strange, but we had a very small one yesterday. I don't know how you found out about it, but
I saw something on Twitter.
Well, I mean, it was funny because I was out blowing leaves in the backyard, and when I finished, my wife said, "You didn't feel the earthquake, did you?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Well, it was quite a little shock." So I looked on the app that every Kiwi has on their phone, which is GeoNet. And it tells you where the earthquake was, how strong it was, and so forth. And it said it was 3.6 and 15 kilometres north of Napier, which is about 5 kilometres from where I live. So right underneath us. And I didn't feel it.
I shouldn't laugh. It's not funny. Jesus, it's pretty scary.
Oh, it's just part of living in New Zealand, that ring of fire and Chile and Argentina and Hawaii and so forth.
I think you're right.
Made the country, ultimately.
Yeah. Loads of stuff to talk about, as ever. I want to start, you know, just by asking about your route into wine, because it's quite unusual, really. You didn't do a winemaking degree or any of that stuff. Is it true you first got interested in wine while you were working in London after university in a pub?
Yes and no. I mean, I lived in London. I learnt cellarcraft in an English pub. So that... You know, setting up the drayman, delivering the big barrels of beer and setting up the beer and hammering spigots into it and learning to, you know, take craft beer, literally English craft beer, and present it perfectly. And I loved that. I mean, that was, you know, I loved that experience. So ultimately, when I got back to New Zealand, and this is with a love of wine, which, you know, we're talking back in the mid-1980s, and there are very few sort of Kiwis as such who are interested in wine. I mean, it wasn't, the world wasn't as it, you know, then as it was now in terms of wine. I saw a job at Collard's in West Auckland advertised, and it was for a cellar hand, so I applied for it. I never got it, but it kind of sowed the seeds. And I went and begged for a job in every winery I could reach on my motorbike in Auckland, and one gave me a job.
So Which one was that?
It was called Ballymore. And in prior sort of life, it was called Ballach Estate. So, you know, it was an old Dalmatian sherry house, quite honestly, that had just been transformed into a producer of table wine. I came in at the right time, became, I suppose, you know, myself and the winemaker. It was a great place to learn and just get the bug to learn more.
Yeah. I mean, so, do you think the fact that you started at the bottom, in a way, has kind of informed your approach to wine as well as the way you relate to the people around you?
Yeah, most definitely. I actually, I've always felt good about managing a cellar and being a winemaker as I've kind of gone up the process, because if I ask someone to do something, I know how to do it myself. And I can both train people if need be, or I can answer questions, or I know how all the equipment works and so forth. So writing cellar ops and just kind of the basics of, you know, a cellar operation, I totally understand all aspects of it. And I think that's been very helpful over the years.
Yeah, I mean, you're not really a white coat winemaker sitting in his little lab looking down on the winery, are you?
No, I'm not really a production winemaker. I'm more, you know, more someone who's interested in taking agriculture, you know, from its roots and then basically, you know, as simply as possible, getting it into the bottle at the other end. So very simple approach these days.
Yeah, I mean, and you moved to Esk after 3 years in your first job, as Grant Edmonds' assistant, and you've been there ever since. I mean, can you tell us a little bit about the winery's history? It was Glenvale in a previous lifetime, I think, wasn't it? And didn't they make a bit of sherry as well? Maybe everybody made sherry in those days.
Everyone literally did make sherry. I mean, the palate was for sweet wine, sweet and alcoholic wine. I mean, you know, I mean, that was, I suppose, the Kiwi taste in the day. I mean, unfortunately, our climate here wasn't particularly well suited to making those styles of wine. So that was a bit unfortunate, dare I say.
It's not Andalusia, is it, really?
No, and the choice of grapes being American hybrids didn't exactly lend themselves to fine wine either. But, you know, Glenvale was at its height, and I mean, this is in the 1970s, the fifth largest winery in New Zealand. So these were, you know, the winery itself, which I stepped into down here, was big sprawling complex with lots of barrel cellars, 23 1930s concrete open top vats for making red wine. Just, you know, it was very old fashioned, sprawling, and a lot of chaos in some respect. But dare I say, I think when we left the winery to go to the new plant over at Te Awa in 2018, the Esk Valley Winery had been every year modified slightly to make it work for and work well for what we endeavoured to do with it. So by that I mean we used gravity a lot. We'd put in fixed lines that were really appropriate and so forth. The concrete vats, I'd learned how to get the best out of them and appreciate them for their, I don't know, what's the word I'm looking for? I mean, just, you know, got a whole lot of stainless steel tanks, and I always put my prized reds into the concrete fermenters. So I like the, not the randomness of it, but just the more earth tones that we would find in the wine. So,
It's interesting. Do you know Alberto Antonini? You probably do, the Italian winemaker. He always says that stainless steel smells of death, concrete smells of life.
and there is a bit too there. I mean, it took me a long time to suss all of this out, because we had 23, and dare I say, the ones that the furthest, they were laid out in the line, and no two of them were alike. So they always had, I think it was the subsoil that was underneath them, different temperatures, where they were in the shade or the sunshine and so forth. Mm. They all had slightly different properties that took many years to learn.
Yeah, I mean, like, so different personalities for each one, and you're dealing with all these different people almost, yeah?
I should have given them all names, never did, but always put the terraces into number two, though, where... where people who come up the stairs and see the fermenter, and during harvest time, it always held the prized wine as such.
Tell us about the terroir of Hawke's Bay. I mean, obviously, as you've already mentioned, the earthquake, occasional earthquake.
Yeah.
And more specifically about the Gimlet Gravels, because you're very closely associated with that as chair of the Wine Growers Association.
Hawke's Bay, I mean, I was going to say it's relatively simple to understand, I think, but that's underestimating it. But surrounded by hills, young. It's a young landscape as such. New Zealand's not an old weathered continent like Europe. You know, constantly in action with earthquakes and so forth. But basically, the from the hills, the eroded material has been dragged down by three main rivers that run through the plains, from the hills through the plains. Mm. They've brought down gravel, which has been eroded with time. There's areas of really free-draining gravels, areas perhaps where there's more sand, silt, and swampy matter, which is tending these days to be used for apples and stone fruit and other forms of agriculture. And we're left with the stony river terraces and the gravel plain of the Gimlet Gravels, which, I mean, it's quite unique in some respect. It's in the heart of Hawke's Bay, far enough from the coast where the sea breezes don't quite reach. It's just infinite gravel. I mean, however deep we've dug the hole, we haven't found anything other than gravel. So
how deep is that? Well, how deep have you gone?
I don't know. I mean, I would say, 5 meters or something, 4 or 5 meters.
Well, that's a lot of gravel.
It's a lot of gravel. And literally, there's no real seams through it as well that holds any moisture. So the dream is to be able to dry farm it, but I probably question whether it's possible, quite honestly. You'll find, you know, in terms of Gimlet Gravel especially, the need for irrigation. But the stones reflect heat. It's, I think, warm enough to ripen Cabernet Sauvignon these days, but not too hot to over-ripen grapes. I think it's kind of... You know, the climate subtly changed, dare I say, over the last, 20 years, and I'd say more noticeably the last 10, as you'd expect, as it is everywhere. But it's subtly getting hotter. The seasons seemingly are becoming earlier. We're now able to ripen Cabernet Sauvignon, which initially was, I don't know, maybe 2 years and 6, something like that. But what I've noticed more than anything is that we used to get tropical cyclones from the east would be our bad weather pattern. And they often used to arrive at the end of March and early April. So that meant that literally we could get the Merlot off in a hurry if we needed to, but Cabernet Sauvignon was the variety that seemed to suffer the most. It seems now those... weather incidents are coming earlier. They're coming in February, early March. Merlot is a grape variety, is the one which is tending to suffer more. And then Cabernet Sauvignon is given the opportunity to ripen through the best of the autumn. So it's changing like that.
Changing.
More than the fact that it's getting hotter. It's just the timings of harvest.
Tell us a little bit more about the terraces, which is your premium vineyard, very famous vineyard, iconic vineyard. I mean, the previous owners that we've already talked about, the Glenvale mob, they planted vineyards there, didn't they? Then they pulled them out and replaced them with pine trees. Tell us first a little bit about the Maori connection, because it's quite a historic site, isn't it?
Yes. I always look at it as that, you know, the Maori people, when they arrived, I mean, approximately 500 years ago, could live wherever they wanted. I mean, there was no one here, obviously. So you found the best sites to build a village, build a house, and so forth. The village Heipipi on top of the terraces vineyard, or the hill that now the terraces vineyard occupies, or as such, was occupied 500 years ago, and people lived there continuously for 400 years, and there were battles fought for it. I mean, we've found, you know, dare I say, skeletons in the vineyard.
Really?
And there's a long history of occupation and so forth on this hillside. And I can understand that. You go to the top of it, it's, first of all, it's frost-free. I mean, it's got panoramic and sweeping views over the whole of Hawke's Bay. So you can see the enemy. There was access to water. There was shellfish in the lagoon, which was nearby. a beautiful site to live as such. And I think a lot of the properties we're looking at in terms of making wine from this sort of grand site, frost-free, early ripening, sea, perhaps just a hint of sea breeze hitting the vineyard, keeping temperatures cool. It's enough fertility in the soil to, you know, sort of keep vines happy and dry farmed, which they have been for the last 15 odd years. It's a pretty magic site, actually, and I love that connection with, you know, the Maori occupiers, obviously, or inhabitants beforehand. So, yeah, the history of the vineyard goes back a long way.
I mean, I find it fascinating that people were fighting over the site. It was such a great place, presumably, to grow crops, right, as you said, but also this lookout point where you could actually see, as you said, the enemy coming.
I mean, you've been there, Tim. I mean, it's pretty spectacular. Spectacular site in the New Zealand context. I mean, it's like taking a piece of the Douro or something and cutting it out of the hillside there and just planting it into the Hawke's Bay landscape. It's, you know, it seems totally out of place with everything around it, but it fits in so perfectly into the landscape.
Tell us a bit more about the soils and the aspect, because it's sort of a bowl, really. It's a circus in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's sort of an amphitheatre as such. I mean, it faces northwest, so it tends to capture all the afternoon sun. And it's quite precipitous. I mean, in terms of the slope on it is very steep. So, A, it becomes frost-free. Secondly, any excess rainfall just seems to find its way down the slope and is gone. And the soil mix is limestone. Basically, it's a limestone hillside with layers of shell running through it. It was obviously an uplifted seabed at some time in its history. And, I mean, a limestone vineyard is pretty rare in New Zealand. You know, it's, and especially in the Hawke's Bay context as well. When you think of Hawke's Bay, you think of gravel soil. So, every other red wine I make is from gravel, and here I've got a limestone based vineyard which has different floral notes to it, different structure and acidity and so forth. And given that we tend to just let things do their own thing in the cellar these days, you can see the noticeable difference when you taste this wine beside the gravel based wines.
And what's it planted with?
It's planted with Malbec, Merlot, and Cabernet Franc. Yeah. So,
but no Cabernet Sauvignon.
Well, funnily enough, there was Cabernet Sauvignon initially till for the first 5 years. There was Cabernet Sauvignon planted in it, but unfortunately, the Cabernet was planted in the coolest part of the vineyard. So it was right at the top. It was where the sea breeze was at its utmost, you know, sort of affecting the vineyard. So, you know, hindsight's a great thing. It would have been great to have the Cabernet planted elsewhere in the vineyard, and it may well still be there. But we replanted that with more Malbec back in 1994. And the wine has since become a Malbec-based red, which, you know, is pretty unique again in a South Sea context as well. And it wasn't anything to do with a love of Argentinian wine or looking to copy Argentina or anything, because, I mean, quite honestly, back then when the vineyard was planted, none of us actually knew that, realistically, that Argentina made wine or certainly had a Malbec-based wine industry. So it was more to do with the success of Dennis Irwin at Matafero in the late 1980s, who was making some pretty stonking red wines in Gisborne, of all places. And I suppose looking to emulate that in some respect. So Malbec it was, and whether it was, you know, the best choice or whatever, it is what it is. It's there, and it's made a wine with certainly a distinct personality.
Yeah, and it's not made every year, is it? So what makes you decide if the vintage is good enough?
Well, I think we certainly seem to be making a lot more often than we used to. And there's a few reasons for that. I think vine age, the fact we're dry farming the vineyard, taking weed sprays and so forth out of it. I think the vines seem healthier and the fruit we're growing is healthier and riper. I think we've got an amazing viticulturalist who's working with the vines. I think there's a difference there as well. But every so often, you know, nature will intervene and there'll be an annulus horribilis, as there is everywhere. And I suppose we're always perhaps trying to make wine which is the equal of the previous harvest, and that's the equal of the previous harvest, and so forth. And I know they've all got their own personality, and I don't know if they are the equal, quite honestly. There's just this, I suppose, a year like 2017 was one which we'd had a succession of great harvests. In 2017, we had a rain-plagued vintage. And although I think we made really good wine, and I could argue that it's the best red wine made in Hawke's Bay in 2017, it still doesn't make it a wine of enough quality and signature power or something, or concentration, to match or to deserve the price that we would sell it at as the terraces.
And what happens to the grapes in lesser years?
Well, we created in 2010, we created a second label called the Hillside, which we use for it. And it's kind of vernacular for the vineyard. So it's along the lines, you know, if I was to go up to onto the estate and ask where Corey, or someone came and saw me and said, "Where's Corey, who's the viticulturalist?" I wouldn't say he's up in the terraces vineyard,
so he's
or
on
he's
the
up
hillside.
In Haper. He's on the hillside. So we always refer to it as the hillside, and it just seemed natural that that was the second label.
And do you have a favourite vintage? I know you're a big fan of the 2013, aren't you?
Yeah, 2013 and 14 were really good paired, dare I say. But I was lucky enough to, Cam Douglas was lucky enough to be writing a story for Decanter magazine, which literally was just published today because someone sent me a link to it. I opened 12 vintages right back to the initial 1991 vintage. The highlights for me, 1995, I mean, absolutely incredible wine at 25 years. 1998, legendary Hawke's Bay harvest. 2002 was almost the year when Hawke's Bay became Napa for a year. So incredibly robust, rich wines. Very fond of 13, 14. And I've got to say, I think the wines we've made of late, 15, 16 and 18, are pretty damn good wines.
What was the 91 like, the first vintage?
Yeah, I mean, that was good. I mean, it's sort of fading slightly. But yeah, in reality, it was, you know, it was picked with 12% alcohol. So it was always going to be pretty wine. And it's still a pretty wine. Believe me, it was the year that my first daughter was born. So kind of bought a few of those. And every so often we'll enjoy one. And it's hanging in there quite nice, but
well,
charming.
That's good to know.
I would say charming wine, and and there's a place for that.
I mean, Hawke's Bay is generally regarded as a red wine region, but you've always made some great whites. You know, you work with Pinot Gris, with Chenin Blanc, with Chardonnay, Verdelho, and now Albarino, as well as Sauvignon Blanc, which we'll maybe talk about in a second. I mean, do white wines require a different approach from reds?
I love making white wine. It's more challenging. There's more aspects at play in some respect. I mean, my red wine making now, I mean, to me, the decisions are mostly made on day of harvest, when you harvest, and, you know, how much you de-stem or how much you crush and so forth. And then I have left it to wild yeast for so many years now. And so I find red wines more simple. I love the results, but in many respects, I think that white wine making, there's more aspects to it. I mean, there's acidity, there's residual sugar in some cases, there's nurturing on lees, there's which barrels you use, whether you use tanks, barrels, big barrels, small barrels, so forth. I find it's much more precise to me, white wine making. I love the challenge of it. And I find that, yeah, I find it more daunting and more fun and perhaps even more satisfying in some respects.
So the reds almost make themselves. I mean, you're being very modest because you're a fantastic winemaker, but is that what you're saying?
Yeah, the reds almost make themselves. So, yeah. I mean, take the terraces, for example, okay? You know, here's this great vineyard that I am privileged enough to be able to make wine from. I've always, the whole concept of, you know, it started when I used to listen to and sort of read about Marcel Dyce's philosophy on making Alsace wine. And, you know, that the vine is a conduit from the soil to the glass. So applying that to the terraces vineyard, how was I going to get the best wine out of that vineyard? And how was I going to get a wine that tasted of the place rather than the cellar? And my idea of great blending and so forth. So it was obvious to me that we needed to co-ferment it. So we need to harvest three varieties that never get co-fermented, or as far as I knew, had ever been co-fermented before.
But on the same day, right?
Yeah, on the same day, and put them into one fermenter and let them turn themselves into a wine of the place. We did that in 2001 and have continued to do it every year since. That means that we need to adapt our viticulture slightly to accommodate it. It means that, you know, we need to choose the right day to do it. And, you know, some years there might be slight compromise in that. But the concept of harvesting the vineyard as one and letting it turn itself into a wine of its own place and a very unique wine is very satisfying.
I mean, Sauvignon Blanc, you've made, I think, Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc since 2007, and now you're kind of coming home in a way, aren't you? Going to make a Hawke's Bay Sauvignon Blanc as well?
Yeah, I like, to me personally, I mean, just from a branding perspective, it's I think, you know, we're a Hawke's Bay brand at heart, and, you know, we used to, prior to 2007, make only Hawke's Bay wine. And, I mean, 2007, you know, for a number of reasons, and, you know, it's been fun making Marlborough wine, believe me. I mean, that first vintage making Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc, it was like going back to winemaking 101 and having to learn about different acidities and different flavors, and you know, it was a really great learning experience. But I think being true to the brand's heart as such, in some respect, making wine from Hawke's Bay is, I think, the next and a really good challenge for us. So making Hawke's Bay Sauvignon Blanc, I mean, tastes different. It should be riper and more tropical in some respect, but it's not. And, you know, how do we make it different from Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc? Well, here I think we may well be employing some malolactic fermentation, some barrel fermentation. Do we make a more Graves orientated style? There's a whole lot of learnings to go on here. So we started this year. This is going to be ongoing development. I like what we did this year. But we also have some new plantings way inland in Hawke's Bay. So this is where you leave the plains, you get right into the hills of Hawke's Bay. I mean, if I drove from here, it would take me an hour to get there. So it's a whole new region in some respect. We've got enough plantings there to certainly satisfy Esk Valley's demand going forward. And that will come on stream probably in 2 years. So
watch this space.
I mean, who knows what's going to come out of there? But when you look at the soils there and the size of the boulders and things, it looks like Marlborough. It's got real Marlborough feel to it. So
I mean, that's another example of you kind of pushing boundaries with your wines. You know, you made New Zealand's first Merlot, its first Malbec, as we've learned, its first Verdelio, I think, and also its first Merlot Rosé. And didn't you make a liqueur Muscat at one point early in your career? I mean, I just wonder how easy it is to innovate like that within a corporate structure, because even though Esk has always been its own entity in a way, you're part and have been part of the Villa Maria group since, I believe, 1987?
Yeah. Yeah, 1986, Sir George Fisternich bought the Glenvale site. So, yes, I've always worked in a corporate environment in some respect, but it's as if I've had my own fiefdom, and I have been encouraged by George. I mean, who was such a, it was an amazing opportunity. I mean, for someone who's kind of as inquisitive as I, and someone who likes perhaps pushing the boundaries, learning, experimenting and so forth, to have the resources of a big company behind me, which has provided resources way beyond what a company of Esk Valley size would ever have if it was a standalone winery, and been given the opportunity and the encouragement to use those resources is an incredibly unique opportunity. So, you know, I might have been doing it for 30 years, but, you know, both what we make and just the job itself has changed, and I've been allowed to you know, change it, and it's changed me, and, you know, and so forth. So it's been an amazing opportunity.
But as you said, 30 years is a long time for any winemaker to stay in the same place, unless it's a family business. I just wonder, you know, why have you remained at Esk? Are you still learning from the vineyards?
Yeah, of course. Absolutely. Learn all the time. And like you say, I mean, there's new varieties. I mean, made some Gamay this year as well. You know, back to making Chenin Blanc, got new vineyards to unlock the secrets of. You know, the wines that I'm making now, we've just got a new tier of wines, actually, for the first time in 30 years. We've, you know, Esk Valley now has a tier for restaurants and sort of fine wine stores in New Zealand. So, you know, things are forever changing, evolving. And, you know, yes, 30 years, unless you work in a family vineyard, well, I've felt this is a family vineyard. I mean, in many respects, I felt I own it. I pretend I own it and have been encouraged to do so. So it's the ideal opportunity, believe me. So, yeah, I've made the most of it, and it's been fun. And I'm sure if George Fistinich would say that it's been good for him as well. So,
yeah, but and you have this enormous privilege to work with these amazing vineyards, especially obviously the terraces. I wonder, does a vineyard like that still surprise you after 30 years, or do you know it so well that you know how it's going to behave in any given vintage?
No, it still surprises me. I was looking at my notebook of the 2017 harvest. Now, 2017, as I alluded to, was kind of a pretty challenging harvest. But when we finally got, I risked it, left it out there through a lot of rain until we got out the other side. And in my diary, I wrote, the last Merlot in Hawke's Bay, and surprise, surprise, it's still in great condition. There will be no better vineyard in Hawke's Bay harvest, or red wine vineyard in Hawke's Bay harvested this year. You know, I mean, I wrote these notes to myself. So that was, you know, that's a surprise. I mean, there's always surprises, Tim. You know, a good part of that too. Here's another one. We were starting to find some trunk disease in the Cabernet Franc. So Corey has been re-trunking the vines, literally just cutting out the trunk disease in it. And as a result of that, the fruit that we're getting from the Cabernet Franc now gets way better fruit set, way better, more consistent berry size, and is performing better than it has for probably two decades. So, you know, there's nice surprises like that as well. So
you're fine-tuning in a way. Yeah?
We're fine-tuning, yes, for sure. And then the wine, and as a result, it means that the winemaking can just be more and more hands-off, quite honestly.
Yeah. I like your description of winemaking, where you said that your job is a mixture of history, romance, design, food and culture. There's obviously a bit of winemaking in there as well.
I'd add agriculture as well.
Agriculture, yeah. I mean, I think it's a refreshing and quite unusual way of looking at wine. Do you think it's a bit more of an old world take on wine, if we could use that term?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, note that it's nowhere in that there's sort of commerce, science, and so forth, right? So maybe it's just reflecting me and who I am and what I can get out of it personally. You know, a cellar full of music, wearing whatever we want to to go to work effectively as long as he's got the steel caps on. And, you know, the travel with the job and the socializing and encouraging people to come to the cellars and welcoming them and educating them and so forth. I mean, it's way more in terms of my job. I mean, it's certainly a life and a lifestyle and so forth. And I've just incorporated all the things that I like in the other parts of my life into my wine life. And yeah. I just think it's been a very easy fit. And is it an old world take? I don't know. I mean, it's a take that everyone should take quite honestly. Life would be better, you know, better for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, you've always been a winemaker with a substantial hinterland, if I may put it that way. You know, you enjoy cooking, fly fishing, cricket, golf, and especially music. I just wonder, does all that help you to keep the job in perspective? I think it does, doesn't it?
I think so, yeah. I mean, it's a big thing. This isn't a job, though. I mean, you know, my wine job is certainly my life. It's, you know, it occupies an inordinate amount of my time, my thoughts, and so forth. But yeah, there's a lot more to me than that, dare I say. But somehow they all fit together. Yeah,
I mean, it sounds like the perfect fit for you, really.
Well, it has been, absolutely, and that's why I tell my children, I tell anyone who will listen that I was lucky enough or bold enough, dare I say, to turn my hobby into my life. So, you know, it's that classic thing that if you do something you like, it's not really a job.
I feel the same way about writing. It's enabled me to go on being a student for the rest of my life, basically.
Exactly.
And living like one. You know?
Exactly.
Yeah. Listen, before you go, because as I said, you're a big music fan and I always love your music tips. Have you got any great new music tips? Maybe something from New Zealand. I've discovered lots of great bands thanks to you.
Yes. Well, I think currently actually New Zealand is blessed with some great female folk singers. And when I say folk singers, I'm not really talking Joni Mitchell here as such, but there'd be three names that I would throw in there who I think are worth a listen. And the first one's called Reb Fountain. And the album that came out actually a year ago, because it's during lockdown, they listened to it, is literally called Reb Fountain. So Reb Fountain. Great, great, great album. Then there's Nadia Reid, who's onto like a third album, I think. Worth a listen as well. So Nadia Reid. And then there's the kind of mad but great, you know, personality and songwriter that is Aldous Harding. And I would recommend her Designer album.
Brilliant. Those are three fantastic tips. I don't know about anybody else listening. I'm going to go and download those right now. I'm going on to Spotify to have a listen. Gordon, it's been brilliant talking to you. Thank you so much. Love your wines. And I love your approach, not only to wine, but to life. I hope to see you soon.
Thank you, Tim. Cheers. Pleasure.
Well, Gordon is certainly a winemaker with a hinterland. One of the most interesting and considered people I know. Next week on Cork Talk, my guest is the wine writer, TV presenter and novelist, Helen McGinn. See you then. Thanks for listening to Cork Talk. If you want to read more reports, articles and tasting notes by me, go to my website, timatkin.com. You can also follow me on Twitter, @timatkin, and on Instagram, @timatkinmw. See you next week.